Like that. All right. Cool. I'm ready. I'm recording. Oh, really? I'm so happy to be here. Thanks for having me on. Thank you very much. I am very happy to be here. Yes. Jack Wakes Up is a mystery crime novel. It's kind of like an action movie, really, is the best way to describe it. It's been referred to as an action movie between two covers. So if you like movies that have guns and comedy and a little bit of violence and a lot of thriller element, you would love the book Jack Wakes Up. If it reads really fast. It's about a one-time, one-hit wonder action movie actor from LA who's up here in San Francisco, gets caught up in a drug deal with some Czechoslovakians who want to do kind of an easy rider, huge amount of cocaine, and drive across the country on motorcycles kind of thing. He gets pulled in on this drug deal with them and kind of acts as the go-between between them and this Colombian drug dealer. All kinds of mayhem and madness ensues. Next thing you know, Jack finds himself knee-deep in a Bay Area drug war. It's fun. It's a lot of fun. Perfect for the plane. My wife, when she first read the first draft, she said, "This would be an awesome plane book." But it's also a good beach book, I think. You know, it's fun to just read it. It'll pull you along, and you'll have a great time with it. So, to write the first draft probably took me about 2 months. August and September of 2005, I wrote it. And basically, my method there was to wake up every morning and write about 1,500 words or so before I did anything else that day. So, I would get up, get cranking. I don't write with an outline. I basically believe that writing is like paddling a boat across an ocean. Writing a novel is like that. And that you basically just have to do one good stroke at a time and have faith that your boat will get to the other side of the ocean. So you might not even know what the shore looks like on the other side or where you're going to wind up or in writing terms, what the ending will look like or what's going to happen. But if you just follow each piece that you put down, make sure to write each sentence carefully and as best you can. I believe in that process to carry you through to the other side, ultimately. Probably about five or six, four to five times, let's say five times. Basically, you know, after I've written a book and I've figured out beginning, middle, and end, gotten the whole thing written, I know so much more about the book at the end than I did at the beginning. And so that's a great time to go back through the beginning and really find the pieces that connect the best with the characters and with what's going to happen. At that point, I can put in foreshadowing or heighten the themes that are going to come into play and be most important in the novel. And I can also really build on the characters from the beginning. As I've gotten to know them, I can strengthen them from the beginning. And also cut out parts that aren't necessary, you know. There's a lot of cutting and fixing and improving that goes on in revision. Sometimes it's clear, but that doesn't make it any easier. It's always really hard to cut because, you know, we get attached to the writing that we do. It's like killing your babies when you have to cut your stuff. And some people say, you know, when you're writing, you have to kill your babies. John Dos Passos said, the only way to tell the quality of a piece of writing is by telling the quality of the pieces that you cut out. So when you're just cutting out the junk, and it's really easy to do that, then your book is still really not that great. But when you're actually forced to cut out pieces that are good and even excellent, just because they don't quite work for the novel, it's harder and harder to do, but it makes the book better and better. So I think, you know, ideally, as I go through the process, the things that I'm working on will get smaller and smaller. So the first couple of times that I go through, it'll really be large thematic sections where I'm figuring out, you know, what the pieces are of the book, which major scenes need to get cut and fixed, which characters need to get heightened, or sometimes, you know, whole events need to get taken out of the text. And so that, the first couple of revisions will focus on really big stuff. And then ideally, I'll get smaller and smaller scale to the point where I'm fixing things within scenes. I know all the scenes that are going to be there will stay in the second draft. And so then I can start fixing things within scenes, changing paragraphs, deleting paragraphs from scenes, and tightening up the dialogue. And then as I keep going forward, you know, some of the drafts are really just fixing language, working with the grammar and stuff like that. But also, there's always a process of incorporating feedback into this whole process. So, you know, I'll get some feedback and information back from a friend of mine who's read it. I had a couple of friends who read Jack Wakes Up while it was in process. And I would incorporate their ideas, talk to them more, show them subsequent drafts and talk about what's starting to work better or what's going on with the revisions that I've made. And there's always sort of some, not workshop, but just sort of talking through and having discussions with people that I can trust as readers as I'm writing in the revision process. Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Well, coming from a short story writing background, in the short story you can write in present tense or past tense. There's not really any difference there. I mean, either way, we understand that this story is a fictitious creation. It's not actually happening somewhere. It never happened in any place, and I'm not trying to tell something true that happened in my life. So it should be okay to use either one. A number of people have remarked that the present tense feels more like a movie. And last time when we talked, you talked about Updike using the present tense in Rabbit Run and him saying that he wanted Rabbit Run to be more like a movie, which was why he used the present tense. And so there's a lot of that out there. For me, I just wanted it to move. I wanted it to move more quickly. I wanted it to have that feeling of things going on and happening and moving from one thing to the next and sort of have more of momentum. So I tried to use the present tense for that. And also, I'm more into the soft S sounds that you get with the present tense than the hard D's that you get with the past tense. So Jack wakes up versus Jack walked down the street would be past tense there. I'm working on it. My father keeps insisting that it needs to be made into a movie. And he reminds me of that at least a couple times a month. So I'm working on it. I was just in LA last weekend and I'm happy to say that I have an agent down there now and I'm talking to her and she's really enthusiastic about the book. So we're hoping that some good things will come together. And you and everyone gets to be an extra once the movie gets made. Absolutely. Everyone, that's their like third question. Can I be an extra when the movie gets made? Yes. Yes, you can. I'll keep that in mind. Maybe if there's a band at one of... There's a couple of strip clubs in the book, and if we have a strip club scene, maybe one of them will have a live band, and you can be a backup tambourine player in the live band. Dressed, of course, if you prefer. No problem. But yeah, I mean, so I really like the present tense. I think it's fun. I've been surprised, actually, to get some reader comments that, oh, this is weird. I'm not used to reading present tense. I guess, you know, just from reading a lot of short stories, I've seen all different kinds of conventions get bent this way and that all over the place. And so I'm really ready for sort of anything when I start reading something. Right. I mean, another thing that you'll see more in the 20th century is the first person happening a lot, and even some second person narratives. But, you know, as kind of a throwback to some of the earlier pulp and 19th century writing, this book is in third person and sort of removed from Jack's point of view a little bit, but it's still all Jack. But rather than saying I all over the place with Jack's narrative, it's a he or Jack narrative. So there's some new and some old in this. I think that's important. So, wait, can you hang on for 1 second? I just want to grab the book so I can come up with some examples. Okay, back at the desk. Yeah, I think it's important to use different diction for different characters. One of the things that we talked about a lot in grad school was the concept of how to do particular dialogue. And you'll notice in a famous book like The Great Gatsby, Gatsby always uses the word sport whenever he's talking. So you know that that's Gatsby when he's talking. In this case, you've seen a lot of ways in different kinds of fiction for people to do accents and different ways that people talk. I'm really not a believer in the concept of changing the way words are spelled to indicate how people talk. I think that's kind of cheating, and also it can confuse the reader. You know the book Br'er Rabbit? We call it Br'er Rabbit because nobody could figure out that it was supposed to be Br'er was supposed to be an abbreviation for Brother Rabbit. And it was supposed to be some sort of accent that involved someone saying brother all the time. So, yeah, so we want to stay away from that kind of stuff. And I don't like, and we want to stay away from using gonna and hafta and stuff like that. And it forces you to be a little bit more creative to change things around by using the diction. But I think it makes for better writing to do that. And it certainly makes for clearer writing. Yes, I can. So one example would be, a short example would be when Jack gets involved with the Czechs in their hotel room and they want to start having a party, Al would say, Jack Palms, let us share with you some blow. And so even just by saying it with a little bit of an accent, even though I'm not very good at it, but just by sort of mixing around the form of the verbs and where the verbs go with the other stuff, it sounds a little bit different. So another example would be after Jack says no, he says, you do not enjoy the blow. Which is kind of like Yoda uses diction really differently. He'll put his stuff at the end of the sentence, his verbs at the end of the sentence. And so everyone always knows it's Yoda when he's talking. Exactly, yeah, they don't use contractions. So another example would be Al saying, you are the one from this movie. It's sort of like all the words are spelled out one at a time. It is a very pleasure to meet you. Also, some syntaxes are just sort of mistakes like that where we know we hear it and we hear that it's wrong, but, you know, just by changing the words around and putting something different in there, it makes it a little bit different, and it develops the character, which is ultimately what you're trying to do with good dialogue. Exactly. It doesn't take any learning curve for you to get it. I mean, you can get it just from the words. You hear it out loud as you're reading it. And I think that really helps a reader engage with the text, get to know the characters better, and, you know, keep plowing through the book and reading with excitement as opposed to having to slow down or get caught on something. Exactly. What's a good Yoda sentence that you would come up with? Wonderful. So there he's like, he's flipped it around completely. It would be, we are happy, but he puts the object at the beginning and then ends with the verb. Very weird. So that's actually a perfect example of using diction to change the way someone talks and to change someone's language. It's a good way to do an accent without doing the crazy spellings. Yeah. That was a lot of work. A lot of energy goes into a book tour. And when I was planning it, I was just kind of like, yeah, I'd like to go here. I'd like to go there. We're going to do it. And then, you know, when it actually comes down to the weekend where you have to do 4 different readings in 4 nights in 4 cities, it really wipes you out. Because, you know, yeah, I was wiped out. And then also with all the podcast excitement that I've had with getting to know the fans out there and really building relationships with them, you know, when you get to a new town like Houston or Phoenix or something like that, you don't want to just do the reading and then go home and rest. You want to get to hang out with those people and talk to them a little bit because you feel like you know them and they're excited to see you and you're visiting. And so you end up going out to the bars and hanging out for a while. It just sort of wears you down. You know, I'm not as young as I used to be. I know, it's like you just have to build times in where you just lay in bed for a couple of hours or something like that. But you always plan so much because it's like, oh, I'll be in Houston only for a day. Well, let me fit this in and that in, and I'll go to lunch with this person. So it all, exactly. So it winds up going crazy a bit, and it's hard, but at the same time, you know, all the work that we've been doing online is fantastic. There are still some things you can only accomplish by getting on the ground and going out there to meet people and visit different places. So in that sense, it's really a great experience. And you know, I feel fortunate to have been able to do it. No, I'm doing a radio show later this week in San Francisco. I did some TV for online stuff. I've been doing some filmings of different readings that I've done, and I did a bibliotech interview with Mark Jeffrey down in LA for mahalo.com. He's doing a great show over there. It's like the evolution of the book in interview episodes. That's a good question. I think it's at bibliotech.com. It's on my blog. Everything is at sethharwood.com, which is my blog. And the bibliotech stuff is at thebibliotechshow.com. Bibliotechshow.com. Yeah. Book lovers. Yeah. Good questions. I've seen your readings and I thought it was great. You know, some of the aardvark material, you read some of that, talked about different things, answered questions from the audience. Particularly, you know, with your show and your book, there's always a ton of questions. So it's pretty easy. Yeah, so that's great. And you were giving away things. I had a great time at your reading. At my reading, no, I was there when you were giving away like weird flash drives that were different characters. Yeah, I like those. Ah. How good plans go away. That's too bad. $80 of smart. That's a lot of Smarties. I would get in trouble if I did something like that, I think. I would end up hurting someone with the Smarties that I was throwing. I try and stay away from stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, the section that I read has kind of been a fine-tuning process. Like, talking to people that I can trust, like my wife and my parents. You know, when I do a reading, I don't know. I was reading in Boston for a while, or I did a couple of readings there, and after every one that my father saw, he would say, "Oh, you should stop at this point, or you should do this part differently, or you got to read this part." And so basically, it's a process of either pleasing the people that are related to me and that end up hearing more than one of these readings, or fine-tuning the part that I read. You can take your pick which one you think. But basically, at this point, you know, I've got the section that I read. I usually read this one section where there's a lot of action that happens and it leaves it with a bit of a cliffhanger. I'll usually mix that with kind of a setup section so that I can read for about 15 to 20 minutes. That's usually the length that I want to go for. And then I'll talk to the audience and answer questions, which usually involve, you know, questions about Jack Wakes Up, about my writing process, about my process of podcasting the book, and why I would give it away for free as audio. Questions about building my audience and how I've done that stuff. Yeah, well, I have a publicist that I was working with here in Berkeley who knew a lot of the West Coast mystery bookstores, and he set me up with those. And then my publicist in New York at Random House helped out a little bit here and there, but mostly she was hands off, and I kind of had to put together everything on my own. It was fine in some ways because it got me in contact with these great booksellers in the mystery community, but it was also a lot of work. Next time I do something like this, I definitely will scale it down a bit. I think I did something like 15 stops this year. It was a lot. So I did about six in different areas around the San Francisco Bay Area. Menlo Park, Oakland, Danville. I did San Diego, San Francisco, New York, two different places in Massachusetts, Scottsdale, Tucson, Houston, Marin up here again, and then last weekend I did two in LA. The biggest crowds were in Phoenix, because Poison Pen really helped out there and they brought in a great crowd. I had a wonderful crowd at Books Inc. in San Francisco, where a lot of my students from City College came out and a lot of people that I know there. My first reading at Kepler's was really good, which is down by Palo Alto. And in Cambridge, Mass., I was able to read at the Harvard Coop. They invited me to come read, and that was just a blowout, awesome reading experience. Houston was also really good for me. Murder by the Book is down there, and people drove from like Fort Worth and Dallas to come to the reading. I was really impressed. People in Texas really drove to get to me. Yeah, it was cool. What? Oh, man. Yeah. Totally. It's also about really good bookstores. You know, some of these booksellers out there have great communities that they've built. And Murder by the Book in Houston and the Poison Pen in Scottsdale are totally like that. Also, the Mystery Bookstore in LA had a great crowd that they brought in. And also, the mystery bookstore, the mysterious bookstore in New York, the mysterious bookshop, Otto Penzler's place. I've done two readings now there in 2 years, and both times the audience there has been fantastic. New York City. Right, it's worked great, and I think those places are going to sell a lot of books. The downside of it has been that there's this thing called BookScan that all the editors and agents in New York really look at for their numbers, and a lot of these independent bookstores don't report to BookScan. I guess it costs them money to enroll in BookScan, and, you know, a lot of bookstores that you go to won't do that little scan gun on the ISBN thing of your the barcode of your book. And I think that's how a lot of the book scan stuff gets in there. So if you go to Barnes & Noble or Borders or something and it does that thing and goes boop, then that's book scan counting it, I guess. Right, and that's where the numbers come from that they count. And so it's weird. They know that a lot of bookstores are being excluded from those counts, but I think they sort of figure as long as they're comparing apples to apples and they're looking at all books that way, then they can kind of gauge relative stuff. But definitely, you know, if you're really targeting the independent bookstores, then you can lose out there a little bit, I found out. Right. Right, I know, it's weird. And it's also, you know, I've heard everything from 50% to 70%, and so no one really knows there. They kind of will multiply by random numbers that they pick somewhere in that range to get a sense about what they think the real sales are. But sometimes it can be up to 6 months or something before they really figure out how many books you've sold. Wow. Are they selling those in bookstores or on the web? And they don't get numbers on that? Wow. That's crazy. You would think that those numbers would be easy to get. Yeah. I know. It's incredible. I mean, you know, publishing last year I published with a really small press, which was Breakneck Books, which was basically a print on demand operation. And this year publishing with Three Rivers Press, an imprint of Random House. I just feel like in the past 2 years I've learned so much as a writer, but also just about the publishing industry in general. Everything from submission process to literally the book going in stores and what happens from that point on as well. You know, it's just been really interesting to see this process from the inside and get to learn just huge amounts about how this all really works and what works and what doesn't. Yeah, there's a lot of things that amaze you and make you scratch your head. You know, on the flip side, I mean, and I think learning all this is really important and will help us in our careers. On the flip side, you know, the publishing industry is really changing. And so I feel like it's exciting to be where we are, where we can start to sort of ride some of these new waves and get in on them before a lot of the publishing industry catches on. I mean, with podcasting and building our audiences this way, you and I have definitely been doing that to our benefit. I mean, that's really how I landed my contract with Three Rivers, by showing that I had a proven audience and, you know, using that audience and working with that audience in different ways to sell books and market myself and my books. You know, it's been a real learning experience. I like Facebook and I like Twitter. The interesting thing has been that it's really been my listeners and my fans who've pulled me into those formats. I mean, I'm not necessarily such an early adopting tech guy, I think. But, you know, when they really pulled me into those things and then started interacting with me on there, I just saw that it was an easy way to interact with the fans. And so I would start to post things on Facebook and post things on Twitter. The more you post things and the more you see people really responding to those right away, you know, not only does it encourage you to do it more, but it kind of just pulls you further into, you could even call it a lot of people call it an addiction to these certain websites and these different social media platforms. But from a business standpoint, yeah, it's great to really get involved there, get more followers on Twitter, more friends on Facebook, and be able to really advertise to them about when I'm coming to a town, what's going on with new things with me, and also find new and better ways to work with them and really involve them in the projects that I'm a part of. How did it get suspended? Were you uploading porn? Oh. Wow. I know, it's weird. I mean, basically this summer I've kind of just given up to the fact that I'm kind of in a really big marketing mode right now. And so I'll wake up and work on Twitter and work on my blog and stuff like that and interact with people. But in the normal mode of writing and really getting into going through a draft and doing the revision process that we've talked about, I feel like it's really important not to be involved in those and that I really need to be able to focus and just stick to working on one thing at a time with the writing. And then later on in the day, maybe I'll get into Twitter or something like that. But there's also, you know, sometimes I just have to get away from the computer for a while. And so that feels like that's important as well. Right. I just like to free write though. Like I'll open up a document in Word and just type on there for a while. And then if I get involved in Twitter, it's like an hour later, I'm like, wait, what have I been doing? What's been happening here? I mean, the thing about it that's cool, though, is that it's really an interaction platform. And so if people want to talk to you, you can talk back and forth with them. I guess what's happening a lot is that email is becoming increasingly for people's jobs. And so a lot of people want to interact with you using something different like Facebook that they only use for personal stuff. And so, you know, there's just different ways of interacting there. I mean, I'll have a different email for my classes and my teaching than I do for my writing stuff. And maybe just instead of having lots of different emails, people have just consolidated to having like a Facebook and a Twitter and then their email for work. I started using Goodreads a while ago, and basically Goodreads has changed a little bit. It used to be really easy to just pop on there and friend a whole bunch of people at once. Now it seems like it's gotten a little bit harder to friend a lot of people that you know. I mean, what I used to do is I would go on there and find someone that I was friends with, and then I'd go to their friend list and see a lot of people that I knew, so I'd friend them through that. Now that seems like that's gotten a little bit different. There's also a new one called Library Thing that I just saw today and that I started using today. And I'll sort of see what the deal is with that. The thing about Goodreads that I like, though, is that it's a place where a lot of people can post reviews of your book and rank it and give it ratings and stuff like that. I found out recently that you can go on there and recommend your book to a lot of people at once. Basically, you can just click through all your friends and recommend your book to them. And I think that's a good way of getting exposure for, yeah, my book is out here, check it out, put it up on your post, and then hopefully that helps to disseminate it to other people. Also, I just think it's interesting, if I'm online and I'm reading some stuff, to post on there about the stuff that I'm reading. This year I was teaching a detective fiction class, and it was fun to post on there about the books that we were doing and the books that I was reading for the class, and hear what other people have to say about them, and also, you know, just get an opportunity to rank some of the stuff that I like, so that, you know, I'm on there as an author, but I think it's also important for people to see, you know, what some of the stuff is that I like to read and that is influencing me and the stuff that I'm reading right now. I've also got a blog on there. It seems like it helps. It's easy to put your blog on there. Same with Facebook. One of the things that's cool about both of those is that if you sort of get into your profile and poke around, there's a way that you can put in the RSS of your blog or your podcast feed, and then those will both update into your profiles on Goodreads and on Facebook. Yeah, you can do it on Goodreads as an author. Someone was telling me that you could do that on Amazon, but I don't know if that's true. You can't believe everything you hear. But I think the idea with Goodreads is that it's sort of a nonpartisan way of saying, these are what we think about these books, but we're not encouraging anyone to buy anything in any particular place. So rather than posting all of your reviews on Amazon, it's a way of kind of taking back that environment and really having a network for people to talk to each other and be friends with each other and recommend books to each other and see other people's recommendations about books without being connected to some sort of marketplace. Super fancy. Yeah, I graduated from the Iowa Writers Workshop, which was the first creative writing graduate program in the United States, and by many accounts is the best. And it was like, you know, I was there, I did my egghead thing, it was great. I learned a hell of a lot there about what makes good writing. And now, as an author in this space, you know, I'm learning a lot about how to get your writing out there and how to show people your work and use new technology. I've been teaching a class with Scott Sigler called Author Bootcamp, where we basically work with authors in a small group setting. They bring in their laptops and we kind of take them through the steps of organizing an online profile using Facebook, Goodreads, Twitter. We show them how to produce audiobooks as podcasts like we've been doing, and we get them hooked up with iTunes feed and Feedburner and all that stuff. And that's been really rewarding. Writer's Digest has invited us to come speak at a conference they're giving in September in New York City on the business of publishing and the business of the book. So that's been great. We're also teaching the Author Bootcamp in November through Stanford. So that's been really great as well. Oh, yeah? We've got to team up. You got to go there? Oh, that place is so cool. Right. Well, we've had that. You know, we've done Author Bootcamp twice in San Francisco. And the first time we thought there would be a lot of people flying in and stuff. And ultimately, you know, the expenses, especially with the economy the way it is now, with flying in and the price for the conference and stuff like that, it can get to be kind of spendy. We were thinking about doing one in New York City. I think the thing that we're going to do with that is just, we have a website for Author Bootcamp, which is authorbootcamp.com. And we've got a lot of stuff going on there. As I've been teaching in online classes for Stanford, I've been teaching creative writing for them online, which has been sort of an education as well in how to use the internet for different things. And so using sort of that as a platform, I think our goal this coming year is going to be to convert the Author Bootcamp class into an online platform. Because just like you, we get a lot of emails from people saying, you know, I'm in Alabama or Maine or Canada, and I'd really like to do Author Bootcamp. How can I get involved in that? And since so much of it is really generating things that will take place in the online space, it seems to make a lot of sense to me that we would have the class online. So we're going to start working toward that. Right. I mean, geographically, you know, it's wonderful to have a podcast audience that's super spread out because it gives you the opportunity to get way more people and they're all over the place. But when you start going out to readings and picking a single space, you know, there could be not too many people listening to your podcast near Newton, Massachusetts, but, you know, in the surrounding 100 miles, there's people all over the place. But getting them to one place can be kind of hard to sort of center them. So online is the thing for that. Author Bootcamp. And, yeah, and Sigler has been a great one to work with on that because he, you know, he's been really on the, he's really on the cutting edge of everything as well. Yeah. Yeah, pretty much that's been my model for the first, I mean, for Jack Wakes Up, getting it into print, I've just basically followed his model. And now that I've gotten a little further, I'm starting to try things on my own. And you know, I think we're both sort of experimenting equally in the space where we are trying things to see what works and trying different publishing methods. You know, there's print on demand out there, but there's also traditional publishing. And there's just a lot of different ways you can do things now. And working with Three Rivers Press has been interesting to see how they do things. But they're also, they've been doing this so long and their corporation is so big that they're very entrenched in a set method. And so it's been interesting to kind of see how that goes and also see, you know, I'd like to try this thing or I'd like to try that thing. And sort of see that in some ways, as an author working on your own, it's great to be able to kind of just go outside of the box and do whatever you want to do. Exactly. Yeah. Or you want to just do something crazy, like give away part of your book online for free. And still, I think the larger publishers aren't into the concept of free yet. You know, Chris Anderson just put out this book on free and it got slammed in The New Yorker by Malcolm Gladwell and it did well in The New York Times. I think it's interesting. People will still take some time to get used to what they think of the word of doing stuff for free. Everywhere I go and I do a reading, people are always wondering, you know, how did you expect to sell books if you were giving stuff away for free? That's still a big question that's out there. But, you know, as an author, putting out stuff for free, if you put out a podcast for free and just look at it as advertising, you know, you're not going to convert 100% or 50% of those people to go out and buy your book. But it's a way that you can do effective advertising on your own from your house without spending a lot of money. Totally. Yeah, I mean, last year I gave away the entire PDF of my book for free, and it got downloaded 80,000 times. This year, Random House would only let me give away the first three chapters, and there were only 20,000 downloads of it. Exactly. I mean, it's kind of like you're sort of just working with that taste in a reader's mouth. I think the reality is that a lot of people are not going to just read an entire PDF of the book. But if you assume that they're going to read a set section or poke around in it to see what they think, you know, they have a much better taste for the book and for you as an author if you're giving them the whole thing than if you're giving them just three chapters. And the reality either way is that they're probably just going to read a little bit of it and then decide if they want to buy it or not. Right. It's hard to give away chapter 8 from my book and just, you know, expect people to get a lot out of it. Yeah. Oh man, there's a lot in the works, a lot going on. The Crime Wave podcast just reached 40 episodes and we're taking a bit of a break with that, but we'll be starting up Crime Wave again in the fall. It's CRIMEWAV.com. That's been a great website where I've been able to introduce a lot of the contemporary crime writers who I'm really impressed with to a lot of the podcasting audience. We do a short story a week there for free, putting them out, read by the authors. That's been great, and a friend of mine, Aldo Calcagno, has been helping me with that. I'm starting the podcast from the hot tub here. It's called the Hot Tub Cast, which is basically my way of just kind of, you know, I've been doing a lot of work this summer, and I've started to feel like the James Brown of podcasting because I'm the hardest working man in entertainment. And you know, what could be more James Brown than getting into the hot tub? So I'm getting in the hot tub, giving myself a little relaxation, and talking to the listeners from that from there, doing a little interviewing in the hot tub without hopefully electrocuting myself, and just kind of doing like a state of this is what's going on with me, and these are my tips for writing and for marketing yourself as a writer. We'll come through the hot tub podcast. I'm working on podcasting a new novel, which is Hub Heartbreak, which will start coming out in the fall, and I just wrapped up doing the podcast of Young Junius, which was kind of a prequel to Jack Wakes Up. Jack Wakes Up is the first book in the Jack Palms crime series, and I've actually got three of those novels up on my site and on iTunes for free to download and listen to in their entirety. And Young Junius is kind of a prequel about one of the secondary characters' experiences as a teenager in Boston. No rest for the weary or the wicked. But, you know, I think it's important, like you were saying earlier, we kind of do have to chill out here and there and just kind of recharge the battery. So I'm going to take some time down in August. You know, August is the time to just relax for a while. And then this fall, I'll be back and slamming things. Awesome. Yeah, likewise. No, that was great.